This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. With me is Reuben Jackson, jazz scholar, poet. And here he is, an opening poem.
The Day Malcolm Died. It is 3:20 in Greencastle, Pennsylvania, a Sunday, 3 days after my best friend's birthday. Yes, it is 1965, and I go to the men's room to wash my hands because my family will be dining at this Pennsylvania Dutch restaurant, and I don't know the people who will feed me. I walk down the carpeted hallway dappled with late winter sun and have a complimentary mint and a glance out a window and leaf through a brochure to see what the Amish are doing these days. I return to the table for four, and my mother, first name Mary to those over 18, doesn't even check for dirt beneath my nails for once in her life. And scanning the menu, I am tempted by the chicken, although the braised beef tips with noodles also calls me, as does some dish with a difficult Dutch name. But I stick to the chicken after practically hyperventilating. And for my girl, Maureen, I just stroll into the gift shop and ask for festive ribbons, then quickly return to the table, talk football, sip water, and listen to a radio bulletin with blood in it. And the table is silent now, my father probably thinking of the day he heard Malcolm X whisper love along 125th Street and more than a few Negroes started breathing.
That's Reuben Jackson. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. He works at the Smithsonian Institution's Duke Ellington Collection, and his poems have been in various journals. Fingering the Keys is from Gut Punch Press. Reuben is a jazz critic. I never know whether you're a musicologist or a scholar or a critic or a reviewer. Aficionado.
I'm a lucky guy with a big record collection.
A jazz lover.
Yes.
And he has written for the Washington Post about jazz, Jazz Times, NPR's All Things Considered, and he contributes to WAMU's Metro Connection and teaches poetry at the Writer Center in Bethesda. Reuben, how did you figure eating in a Pennsylvania Dutch restaurant juxtaposing to Malcolm X?
Well, the first thing I want to say about the poem is it's an homage to Frank O'Hara's, I'd say, well-known poem, The Day Lady Died. And this this poem was the result of an assignment I actually gave to, well, some students at the Writer Center and prior to that with D.C. Writers Corps, with middle school students. And we were doing, I call them variations on a theme. And what happened, though, was I was walking down the hallway in the museum and a lady asked for directions. And I forget what she was looking for. And she said in passing that she was from Greencastle, Pennsylvania, which is a little town in Pennsylvania Dutch country. And I said, you know, my parents and I were in a restaurant the day Malcolm X was assassinated in Greencastle. And she said, well, it could have only been one of two restaurants, because I guess there were only one or two restaurants at the time. And it just kind of clicked that way. And it was, I think what I was aiming for, though, was this trying to juxtapose the kind of the pastoral and familial with a tragic event. And lately, when I say lately, I mean the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, I've been looking at my parents' relationship and the fact that they were in some ways opposite sort of kind of political poles, if you will, and just kind of recalling vignettes from childhood in which they were the stars. And so I think this was just kind of one of those.
Will this be the heart of a new book, a look at your parents' relationships?
That's a good question. I would say I hope so. You don't know what's going to tap you on the shoulder and say, you know, write about this. But I think part of it has to do with, it's that kind of middle-aged thing when you start kind of looking back on your life. I'm sure that the fact that my mother's illness and having her placed in a nursing home kind of, it provides some sense of I don't want to say summing up, but certainly reviewing that which has gone before.
Well, certainly in the figure eight, where they came together and where they intersected is where you are.
Exactly.
So it's very interesting to look at that. This is Reuben Jackson talking. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and he's going to read to us.
Okay, this is actually another Frank O'Hara homage. I loved and still love his work a great deal. And the poem, this is based on a poem of his called Avenue A, but it's locally based. It's called 14th and T. We hardly ever hear doo-wop anymore. So no wonder it's so beautiful when we look up suddenly and there it is, sailing through an open window, brilliant, soft, chordal hues, and a longing falsetto warms your heart and your memories of Darla Johnson's emerald green eyes. I want some fried fish. You want some couscous. I love the orange kufi Jamal gave me and the sari your mother gave you. It is more heartbreaking than spring, the heavens breaking open like the dark, mysterious curtains at the Howard Theater and then reassembling after every honeyed voice completes its wistful message that is further from our small selves than the upstairs balcony and the temporary passions of a kiss. Every ballad the radio plays is too entrancing. These are my romantic declarations. I'd hope there be more oral tenderness to come, as in the past, so many. But for now, Jesse Belvin's voice is revealing itself like a pearl to my equally naked heart.
That's Reuben Jackson, and we are glad. This is what Joseph Brodsky said about him. I admire the integrity of Mr. Jackson's style, an integrity that doesn't result in monotony. I admire the consonance of his diction and his subject matter. What distinguishes poetry from other arts is the economy of its means, and Mr. Jackson's poems are truly remarkable for the restraint, for their utter absence of pretense or the use of monosyllabic wit, and the clarity of his colloquialisms. How did you ever get to forge his signature? Really?
Oh, that's very clever.
I think you were cited as the winner of the Columbia Book Award.
Right.
And Joseph Brodsky.
He was the judge.
Must have been the judge. Right, yes. Yeah. So right. He goes on, his lyrical pitch is high and abrupt. And if everyone's very nice, I will read, every time there's a lull in the conversation, I'll read another sentence from Mr. Brodsky. But right now we're going to hear more from Reuben. Reuben Jackson.
This is yet another poem looking at the Washington, D.C. of my youth. 14th and T is part of that. And this was, again, thinking about my youth and my mother in this case. I was thinking about the place she went to get her hair fixed, and this is kind of the first sketch of that place. I called it Letitia's House of Beauty. Long before NASA thought Negroes worthy of exploring heavens, dark as we were once, Sarah Wilcox and countless other sisters, legs crossed like stars in a constellation, spent nearly every Saturday beneath moaning space helmet-sized dryers, trying to straighten and perfect that which was round and lovely as a planet, distant as the men upstate.
That's a terrific poem. And you know why? I have this theory. Well, first of all, there's a lot of longing in your poetry, which is why everyone loves you. I was thinking, why does everyone love Reuben? And it is that we want love. We want to hear about love. We want to hear the search for love. And I have this theory that all people in the world operate from a certain baseline of disappointment.
Yeah, I think that's true.
You know what I mean?
I think that's true.
More or less. Mm-hmm. And whether you win the lottery or whether you got hit by a car. And so all poetry is about how we orchestrate that. And I think the amount of love that we give the poem is how much we can relate to our own wish, our own yearning. And in your poetry, you do capture that.
Well, thank you. I think that as I've gotten older, I've become more comfortable with it. I remember reading a quote by a saxophonist who was actually a poet and a playwright as well, Archie Shepp, and he said something like, I passed through the insipid panorama of Americana with an enormous romanticism It has never left me. And that's certainly true for me. And I remember as a child not knowing, not being able to find the words for these feelings, but hearing certain composers and arrangers who were kind of known for this kind of wistful, yearning stuff. And that was the kind of music really drew me to the stereo, and I'd lean into it like the wind, you know, and like, what is this?
Oh.
And certain musicians, I tell people I tend to be drawn to those sort of wistful romantics. And the musicians I loved growing up, and I guess I'm still growing up, were people like the saxophonist Ben Webster and Marvin Gaye and, you know, Billie Holiday, those people who were kind of sort of wrench your heart. Or someone once said, these singers who had a tear in their voice. And Frank Sinatra, especially Frank Sinatra. So
you do directly dialogue with musicians in your poetry. You actually do. You call them by name. And entertainers, actually. Major Jackson does this with poets.
Mm-hmm.
His new
mm-hmm.
book, Hoops, he talks to Miss Lucille, and he talks to Miss Dove and to Gwen. But interestingly, you do it with musicians. So music is very high there on your creative priorities, right up there with poetry, I would say.
I would say so. I don't separate them, though, because I mean, certainly on a technical sense, you can talk about the relationship between music and poetry, and, you know, we could talk about assonance and dissonance and all those sorts of things, which both genres use. But I think subconsciously I first began to understand what was possible within the context of an art form or genre via music. And I often say that listening to people like, say, Willie Dixon, the great bassist, and I call him poet, you know, that sort of terse approach to language and, like, the use of metaphor in blues lyrics. I mean, all those sorts of things, I think, have helped me try to write better poems. But, I mean, there is no doubt that the music is there. But, see, I don't really draw a distinction between, say, Dylan Thomas and Sam Cooke, because they both make me fall on the floor and go, oh, my goodness, I wish I could have done that.
It's great. The fall on the floor theory is good to go by. And as a critic, are you merciful?
You know, I try. I haven't done it in a while, first and foremost. But I try to. I think the critic's job is to try as best as he or she can to evaluate what the artist is doing, not what we want them to do. And I think a lot of, you know, you might see somebody, metaphorically speaking, think, boy, gee, I wish they'd worn a short sleeve shirt as opposed to that long sleeve polyester thing. And maybe I see critics take off from that thinking, well, they don't do what they did in 1977. But I don't think that's what we were supposed to do. And so it's how successful the artist is in going where they're attempting to go.
It'd be nice if every critic were on the side of the creator.
Yeah, but it's a knife fight sometimes.
Reuben Jackson. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And here's his own poetry. Is this new work that will be a new book?
Well, these are, I tried to bring things which have been published. These are from the online magazine Beltway. And it's funny. The other day I was on the subway and a woman walked up to me and said, are you ever doing another book? And I said, gosh, you make me feel like, I don't mean this in the qualitative. I said, you make me feel like Ralph Ellison, you know. But I so enjoy teaching now that it's I don't want to say it's harder, but that really is my passion.
Well, that's interesting because I think we only have so much passion per moment. And when you're teaching, if you're teaching well, that's as creative as it gets.
Oh, it's wonderful.
It's like being a mother. I mean, how you can just be, there's nothing more fulfilling and creative.
To me, it's kind of like, I said to somebody once, this is the closest I'll ever come to being Count Basie. Because if, you know, you're trying to get people to delve into whatever it is they want to say. And I always tell students, look, don't tell me what what you think I want to hear. Don't write what you think a poem's supposed to sound like. So, you know, if I'm asking them to just do a sketch, just kind of like their first memories. Look, just forget about me. Just tell me what it is you have inside. And it's not unlike, you know, Count Basie pointing to Lester Young or Dickie Wells or somebody in the orchestra. And, you know, what makes those recordings so wonderful? It's that Lester Young was playing himself, you know, as was Dickie Wells, as was Count Basie or Joe Jones or any of those musicians. And see, that's another place where I think, for me, the music and the poetry intersect. You know, it's like Lester Young once said to somebody, he said, you know, you can't join the throng if you don't sing your own song or something like that. And you know, what is it you have to say as a poet? What is it, you know, I have to say about, you know, traffic jams or, you know, couscous or, you know, Carmen Cavallaro or, you know, whomever. So it's that which makes it interesting. You know?
Reuben Jackson, he makes it interesting. Here's his own poetry.
Okay. Here's another one of my big heartbreak soulmates or something. Ben Webster, the saxophonist Ben Webster. And this actually, I wrote this after seeing some footage of Ben Webster playing the Billy Strayhorn ballad Chelsea Bridge. And he had a tendency to roll his eyes up in his head as he was playing. And then, of course, that Whitney Balliot called him a huge-toned airborne marvel. And that sound would come out. So anyway, this is for Ben Webster. Where do his eyes go when he plays ballads? Higher than smoke fogging the room, symbols which rustle God's earlobes like kisses. A friend swears there's a skylight in his hat where notes gather before plunging toward the bell of his tenor, while Ben gazes longingly up the skirts of stars.
Reuben Jackson, he cannot resist being Reuben Jackson, try as he does. And we're talking about music and poetry, so the inevitable is language poetry. I said I was going to try to puzzle out what it was, and we cannot sneer at avant-gardism. I mean, you certainly wouldn't sneer at Anthony Braxton, would you?
Or no.
The new Chicago Arts Quartet, whatever they're called. But the language poet, I've been reading a book about it, and I know now what they're trying to do. Do you know what they're trying to do?
No, you lead the way.
Okay,
here.
If you and I, first of all, mm-hmm. Charles Bernstein says, it comes from something other than suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what a terrible thought.
Uh-oh.
That leaves out the Italians and the Africans. I think all the language.
I have to retire.
It has to be. They must all be from Australia
this
or Canada.
This is it. Okay.
And, but quite seriously, they say that in order to establish the present, which I think many avant-garde jazz musicians do, is to wipe away cultural identity and wipe away sex, gender, everything to create something which is so just now of the present that it doesn't make what they call the lyric error. The lyric error.
Lyric error.
Well, that was in terms of women's poetry mm-hmm. that were not language poets. So can we refer to jazz in any way that way? No, because it's so cultural.
Yeah, and it's an interesting
it's just a theory, too.
Well, it's an interesting manifesto, if you will. But and when you were saying that, I was thinking about, well, again, my youth and knowing that if our family went to Georgia each Easter, you know, we'd leave D.C. and then you go to Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina. You know, each state had its different flavor. And see, for me, of course, with music, the radio was on. And so, like, the DJs in Raleigh would be different from the DJs in, say, Columbia, South Carolina. And my point is that, for me at least, those flavors, or as the kids say, the flavors, you know, are what make music and poetry and other things compelling. And it's how, to me, you know, it's like how you stir the grits that's makes it interesting. And
uh-huh.
And this could be, I mean, it could be a generational thing. I you know, there's certain things I acknowledge with with middle age, and it's not to, you know, impugn what they're doing.
You think young people are doing it?
It depends. You know, a lot of the students I worked with when I was teaching DC Writers Corps were, of course, influenced by hip hop. And I would say that first, they helped me a great deal with writing because in their own way, they were interested in, you know, they'd say, make sure this poem, this piece is tight. So they understood revision. They understood, and I also think they understood the power of language in a way that maybe those of us who've been, as the old folks used to say, colleged, might forget, you know, that emotional impact as well as kind of the oral beauty of it all. So,
but I look at hip-hop and I've got all of the aspects of every great art. We've got the sensual, the thinking part. We've got the intuitive part. We have the feeling part. I mean, it's all there, just like any, like Latin poetry or anything else. Ruben's all there, and he's all here. And he's going to read another poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress.
Okay. This piece I actually wrote after I was kind of perusing a collection we obtained a few years ago at the Smithsonian, materials from the Scurlock Studio, which was a pretty well-known African-American photo studio here in D.C. And there was a shot of some children with Santa Claus from, I don't know, I guess like the 30s. And I just saw it, and it's the same thing I do if we're at a yard sale or something, and you see people in a photograph, and maybe it's like a couple smiling, and that's that poetry thing, you know. I guess it's a blessing and a curse, but you pick it up and you think, you know, what day was this? What did they have for lunch? You know, what did he pay? Where, you know, that sort of thing is. Are they still around? What was his favorite color? What was her favorite color? So that sort of that side spurred this piece on, and I really just I just call it a photo at Christmas. But this was taken here in D.C., the photograph was. Was Santa subjected to Jim Crow laws? If so, would each anxious assembled child, more hues than the changing sky at sunset, be visited only after Spring Valley and Bethesda were sated? Or would they receive hand-me-down soldiers, crippled like the physical equipment in colored schools? But I was 7 at the time, more fearless than Rudolph or Robeson. No hate-stained bearded man, if that were the case, could drown the bliss of huddling beside Maureen Watson as the shutter clicked like new skates kissing the ice.
I'm so glad you found that picture. Are you an archivist or an archivist?
In Georgia, with my relatives, I'm an archivist.
And that's at the Smithsonian. And you are the associate curator for the Duke Ellington collection, right?
Right.
Do we know anything more about Duke Ellington than we knew 10 years ago?
I'd say more and less. Duke Ellington reminds me a lot of, well, first of all, he reminds you of no one, but Langston Hughes, and I'll tell you why I say that. They both strike me as people who truly loved humanity, who had this very genuine, very affable nature, but were extremely private. They had this kind way of stiff-arming the world. And I think as time goes on, we seem to know less, in a sense, about Ellington, I mean, kind of the inner workings, which I think he preferred, because it seems to me that his, for him, the main idea was the music. And you know, there's certain people, when you're growing up, you'll hear someone say, oh, well, so-and-so was great. You know, George Washington was great, or you know, Fannie Lou Hamer was great. And sometimes you hear it and it's just people say it because they've heard other people say it. But I think that Duke Ellington was great, or as we said in the 70s, deep in ways we still haven't begun to understand, because he was such a, well, like in a sense, Louis Armstrong, who was this kind of affable revolutionary. And, you know, Ellington could kind of come on stage and he'd play these hits that everybody knew, but, you know, within the context of an arrangement, there was just some radical harmony or counterline, which would make a lot of, you know, music, like harmony and theory teachers go, oh my gosh, what the heck is he doing? So he understood, I think, what his place, how great he was, but he was not kind of stiff, you know, or stuck up about it.
And this is Reuben Jackson. We're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're back. Here's another poem.
Okay, this is going back. I grew up here in D.C., as some people know, and I often say my education came from the school of well, my father always said, "Boy, you don't know nothing about jazz." So I said I went to "Boy, you don't know nothing about jazz" university, but I would listen to records in the basement of my my parents' house, and this my father loved this piece. It was actually a hit for Cannonball Adderley called "Mercy, Mercy, Mercy," and I remember holding the 45 in my hand and trying to, you know, they put the composers' names in parens under the title, and it was written by the Austrian keyboardist composer Joseph Zawinul, and I was like, and I'm a kid, I'm going, what is this? So that's anyway, that's kind of the impetus for the poem, "Mercy, Mercy, Mercy." For Cannonball Adderley and Joe Zawinul. How many words, much less composers' names, begin with Z? Zem Zimmerel, my unabashedly square cousin Harry proclaimed between vigorous swigs of club soda. Joey and I ignored him like a song by Elvis Presley. Passed the gleaming black disc back and forth like a riff, fumbled the name like poor sight readers massacring confirmation. Zawinul, Zawinul, what were his parents thinking, Joey wondered, placing the slow blue groove beneath the genuine, or so the salesman said, diamond needle. Cannonball Adderley climbing the pop charts, unbelievable as Bull Connor's ignorance, James Brown's footwork. Don't tell anybody he's a jazz musician, my father warned over dinner. That would ruin everything.
What a good line. We know so much about your father. Go on with another poem.
Okay. This one's called "Hard Bop." And those of you familiar with, you know, Miles Davis's career know that he was blackjacked by New York City cops outside of Birdland in the 50s. So this kind of spurred this poem on, "Hard Bop." Oh, and something Langston Hughes said. He said that bebop was invented by New York City policemen when they'd hit you with their blackjacks, and the sound was bebop. So, hard bop. Ask Miles, one of the real founding fathers, cooling out between sets at Birdland as New York's finest approach, about the quote-unquote cultural context for the paradiddles and flams played upside his head that steaming summer night. Had his veins not been infused with that which he birthed some time back, he might have yelled a warning loud enough for Amadou Diallo and other deceased, uncredited sidemen to hear before he, too, bled onto Gotham's storied turf like a trumpet passage on a poorly mixed recording, and his life force, like the sails of living jazz musicians, went away.
Here's more what Nobel Prize-winning author Joseph Brodsky says about Reuben Jackson. He creates a mental climate rather than paints a picture. I like that. In a curious way, he reminds me of Philip Larkin, not in the least because of the latter's love for jazz, yet what in Larkin's poems is the needle extracting a recorded sound from a revolving disc is in Reuben Jackson's case, the man's own live improvisation. A Genuine Solo. That's a good title for your next book.
A Genuine Solo. Yeah.
It should be.
That's good.
A Genuine Solo.
That's good.
And I think that it's meant to be. You probably have 60 poems ready.
I just have to sit down and, yeah, probably so.
Yeah, when this course is over at the Writers' Center. Let's have another poem, Reuben. Reuben Jackson is his name.
We Insist. The title is taken from a record Max Roach did with his then-wife, Abby Lincoln. It's called We Insist, the Freedom Now Suite. And these are all on the Jazz Journalist Association website. But I call these like Frank O'Hara had lunch poems. These are sort of my basement poems. And again, they kind of stem from our neighborhood and my first scent of music, I guess you'd say. We Insist, Freedom Now Suite. The only smells my mother hated more than the cut-rate scotch on father's breath were the body oils worn by polite, non-drinking neighbors with, as she put it, tongue-twisting names who invited my brother and I beside the stereo which never slept, not to share risque red fox jokes, but the names of African kingdoms, Arabic names and prophets, nary a mention of Ralph Bunch, and jazz, which did not coddle or allay America's alabaster fears, the way Red Devil Lie once scalded our nappy hair into submission. Like Malcolm X bad-mouthing the man, she felt it was only a matter of time before we would take on Truesdale Elementary's fair-skinned faculty and be murdered, or worse, exiled to a land without integrated lunch counters.
What a line. I have Freedom Now, Abby Lincoln. I do have that. And you see, you want me to, now I want to hold on to everything till the day I die, because they all are so precious, aren't they?
I think it's true. I think one of the great things about writing, though, is that it kind of gives you a sense, or the opportunity to, I guess for want of a better word, kind of bear witness and release some of it in a way, because there is a, like Thelonious Monk would always tell people, he'd say, always know. And see, there is so much to know. And, you know, I marvel. Sometimes I run into friends of mine who are still very active as critics, and they'll say, what are you listening to, you know, that's new? And I'll say, oh, I'm still hung up on Ravel. And my point is that not that I'm sticking myself in a particular time period, but, you know, you go back and hear something or you go back and read a poem and there's something new you didn't hear or see before. So it's helped me to understand musicians like, say, Miles Davis, who were able to continually move, because I know how easily one could just fall in love with a particular way of doing things and just, you know, return to that bed over and over and over again.
Just quickly, can you describe Miles Davis at the end? When we saw him in Washington, and it was so curious. It was just like he stood by a potted plant and just did that one beautiful note. Can you tell me what he was doing at the end?
This is going to be a biased answer, because I have that sound is just, it's just in my heart.
Oh.
And I think that he too was someone who was kind of bedeviled with an image. And the public kept thinking, oh, yeah, that's the guy who turns his back on the audience. Though, you know, he would say, you wouldn't say that to a conductor who was turning his back.
Oh, that's a good point.
And I think he was just
into the music.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
But that sound, that, say no more. That sound is in your heart. Oh. And that sound I can remember him making, and that's like the whole piece was that one note almost, is in my heart. And so let's just leave it there. Reuben Jackson, I'm Grace.
Let us go into the house of the Lord. Amir and I keep a death watch over the last stick of jasmine-scented spiritual sky incense, turning the basement into a den and den of iniquity, my father's exact words. While Carlos Santana and John McLaughlin's fingers speak in tongues on six-string guitars, the Trinity doubled. Congas rumble like horse hooves, and Khalid Yassin's organ washes over the singing like water from a baptismal fount. We, for once, were not afraid of approaching. Evening sun illuminating the globe, gold-pated pharaohs around our necks. This is who we were once, Amir whispers, caressing Ramsey's strong, impassive face. Jazz-smitten teenagers in a funk rock world, who would hold us when the music completed itself and we said goodbye? I just want to say, you know, something. This in the early 70s, you know, I heard a lot of music, and as I said, in my parents' basement. And I remember kind of striking out on my own in the early 70s. This was pre-WPFW. This is when Howard University Station, WHUR, was a jazz station. And I would listen and I would hear these, you know, these kind of classic mellifluous voice FM DJs, and they'd play this music and they'd say, you know, this was so-and-so. And these were names I never heard. And there were a few of us in the neighborhood who were just so smitten that we'd write these names down and we'd go to the record stores, which don't exist here in D.C. anymore, and it was our way of trying to get on the carousel, so to speak. But it conflicted in some ways with the stuff that my parents loved. Because if you brought in, say, like a late period Coltrane, like Meditations or something like that, and contrast that with, say, something, you know, like a bassy recording. And so my parents would hear these saxophones kind of, you know, speaking in tongues in the basement. They say, boy, you know, it sounds like somebody's strangling saxophones down there. But that was our gateway into this. And I later learned, of course, that it wasn't, as a friend of mine said, it's not either or, it's both and. But you have to kind of, I guess in life, you know, you sort of put your feet down and stake your claim, and then you see that, you know, it's sort of all water in the ocean. But at that time, it's like, you know, these are the musicians of my generation. So it was, you know, like Pharoah Sanders and Cecil Taylor and all those people. And it was exciting for me and for the peers I had who liked it. But it was also kind of lonesome, too, because most of our friends were strictly listening to more top 40 stuff. And but
I guess, who was top 40 then?
Well, in the early 70s, you know, that's a good
Marvin
question.
Gaye was
yeah,
he?
which is okay too.
Yeah, that's know? Okay.
But I think people sometimes wanted you, and sometimes they still do. They want you to choose. It's like you have to. It has to be, you know, Marvin Gaye or Pharoah Sanders
or Rebel.
And of course, why not both?
And that's why I like the metaphor of the carousel.
Mm,
but
yeah,
also, there's that tragic carousel poem of Langston Hughes, where the child is looking. It's during segregation, and she says,
right,
which horse is mine?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
No, it's true.
So that the carousel is a beautiful image. Also, I love the idea of inclusiveness and not, you know, I'm square if I like this kind of music. I listened to a country song I actually liked. I used to think it was like fingernails on a blackboard, you know. But I thought, now I'm interested in the way those lyrics were put together.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something. Everything has a little truth in it in music.
It's true. I remember reading, actually hearing, Quincy Jones said, this was in a documentary which was done some years ago called Listen Up, The Lives of Quincy Jones. And he was talking about his, you know, he met Ray Charles in Seattle when they were both very young. And Quincy Jones said, you know, we had to play everything in those bands. And he said once, Ray Charles came to him and said, boy, I can't stand playing these, you know, schottisches and polkas at these. And he said, well, listen, every music has its soul. And if you kind of surrender to it, it's all soulful. And, you know, I think you can, there's so many parallels with that. There are a number of pieces I've heard. Because some people often ask you, well, you're a poet. What do you think about hip-hop? You know, and I said, boy, there are a number of pieces I wish I had written. And even some of the pieces which offend me are so skillfully crafted, mm-hmm, that I try to learn from that. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I don't see any contradiction in loving, you know, some
any
things
kind
that,
of
like,
music,
that Tupac Shakur did. Or, like, I love Yeats, you know, and when, like, Buck Owens just died, I was really upset. I really love Buck Owens and Stravinsky. And, you know, Charlie Parker said, music's so vast, you can't. And whether it's the music of poetry or, you know, what we think of when we talk about music in a more literal sense, there's so much. And I think there's so much for everyone, you know.
And
so,
when you throw in the ingredient of Quincy Jones, who's on the charge with love, He's not just about, he's on the charge
yeah.
with love.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what I think you get a lot of your power from, too. That we see that tremendous impetus, which is just comes from that approbation of life and that love of music and creativity. I just think he is truly a genius.
Well, I agree. And I was thinking about, I mean, there's another way that musicians and poets, among others, have inspired me. It's such a sort of trite way to put it, but I'll leave it at that. But that willingness or the courage it takes to not back away from, you know, that which is given to you.
Oh.
And that notion has become more important to me as I've gotten older. But, you know, how, again, it comes back to this playing the music you're given. And, you know, what do we have ultimately but that? You know, how do we play life? And I think, you know, these poems are maybe, you know, it's like a small sample of that. But, you know, how do we tie our shoes? How do we kiss? How do we vote? You know, all these things are part and parcel of the way, you know, there are variations on the theme, so to speak. So
I think the Bible says something about giving the gift you were given.
Yes. And I think that's true.
It's the only thing I know, though.
That's a good one. Outward Bound. Outward Bound is the title of an Eric Dolphy album. The alto saxophonist, bass clarinetist, flautist Eric Dolphy. And this goes back to elementary school, too. Outward Bound. We brought hope smaller than a slave ship's quarters to Truesdale Elementary's Negro History Week audition. Yet I, too, had a dream that one day someone other than Aubrey Winters would get to portray Booker T. Washington. Only Yusef Sharif, he of the mysterious, reputedly non-Christian jazz-caressing clan, whose head supposedly squandered a month's rent watching Coltrane chase and capture beauty at Birdland, was not stressed. After taping paintbrush bristles to his chin, unleashing a section of garden hose from his book bag, he stood atop a scuffed desk and proclaimed himself Eric Dolphy, fervently fingering the harmless snake, whistling the great reed man's run on melodies which, not surprisingly, did not move Miss Everett, she of the "we shall overcome only if we keep our commercially futile selves in check" school of pre-blackness. But he charmed a cadre of birds outside anyway.
Outward Bound, is that called? What was the name of that school?
Truesdale Elementary. It's
still there?
Northwest, oh yeah.
And is that teacher accurately named?
She's a composite. Oh, no.
I was going
no,
to say.
It's a small town.
My 7-year-old grandson said to me yesterday, "I'm going to use a pen name." And I said, good
smart,
idea.
Smart,
good
very
idea.
Smart. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Reuben Jackson's here. I'm Grace Cavalieri. And we're reading about his life in a way, because we now have the title for your new book, which could be either, you have a choice.
Okay,
it could be a genuine solo or just solo performance.
Good.
That
good
can be fine. Oh, now, the memoirs, however, which I insist upon, and I'm going to call Karen every night on her cell phone to get you started, is Gateway. Isn't that a good one? Because you used the music in the basement as a gateway to who you would become. Somehow, that has to be in it. But the memoirs have got to be done.
That's an interesting. I think
you mean
more
it's the first
it.
Time you've ever thought of that?
I know. I think more about it.
It's Washington and, history. It's musicology. It's the history of poetry. It's
funny you said that, because I was in there's a Starbucks on 7th and E Street, and I said to somebody, "Do you know what this used to be?" And they said, "No." I said, "This was DC Space," and I was like one of those like the elders who tell you, you know, boy, you know, I used to catch fish over in that corner somewhere back in. And I thought, first thing, it made me laugh, because I thought, boy, you're becoming one of those people. But things change so rapidly.
It breaks my heart.
And
I go down 7th Street and I see DC Space, and I remember when we would go in there, we'd need a tetanus shot first.
It's true.
But the soup was terrific. There was a little proscenium and some jazz players sometimes, and sometimes something worse.
No, it's true.
And here it is. It's gentrified. It's collegeed.
And then I was looking, and the barista was looking at me like, what is this old guy talking about? But I said, you know, I used to come here and do open mic. It's like kind of like where you, I guess like horn players woodshedding. So, boy, you know, I sort of cut my iambic teeth in this place.
Your iambic teeth. There, now, I can't think of the book for that title. Yeah, and let's have a poem and see if it fits.
Okay. Jukebox. Blue echoes of a colored past in a room where Coke tumbled from bottles shapely as the unattainable Brenda Johnson, where we spun like hit singles, like the planet to which Sam Cooke sent us, a planet which still has no name.
Oh, jukebox. I had one in my grandmother's restaurant in Trenton, and I used to get all the Louis Prima records. They were this thick, at least a half an inch, 78s. By the time they were played, you could hardly hear what he said.
He was something else.
Yeah. Reuben Jackson, we can't get enough of you.
Let's see. This is, again, going back to the neighborhood. This piece is called Frank. And I think whether students or people on the street stop and say, well, what do you recommend? You know, what makes a writer? And I say, foolishness. No, I'm kidding. But I say, well, you have to be nosy. You really have to watch things and really just kind of delve into them. And because I was somewhat shy as a child, you know, I would just kind of sit and watch people. And this piece is about a guy in our neighborhood. Well, his name is Frank. And I'll read the poem. Frank was fired from the El Diablos for inserting Hendrix licks into their celebrated James Brown medley. There was silence as he bent to unplug his wah-wah pedal. Metal tongue banished from their matching suits and rote precision choreography. One year later, the ghetto was teeming with posthumous interest. Frank's door was bruised from all the knocking. But that Friday afternoon, the El Diablo stood waiting for his skyline of amps to come down. So this guy was just...
skylight of amps.
Well, it's like bringing this different sensibility into something, and people were like, whoa.
What I'm impressed with is that people stop you on the subway and ask you when you're getting a new book. People stop you on the street. Reuben, you're famous.
Flattering. Well, it's very flattering.
You have to stop wearing that T-shirt with your name all over it. Really?
Right. Didn't you used to be?
Here, he used to be and he still is. Let's have another poem.
Let's see. This is called Old Music. And I know most of these poems, of course, kind of focus in on them. Writing poems about old music is beginning to make me feel like one of those relatives you consciously avoid at family gatherings. The ones who say, today's songs are groovy enough, but just let them tell you about some ghost they saw at the Howard, the Fillmore, the Apollo, wherever. I don't think a lifelong passion for Hendrix puts me in that boat, but this isn't the same as discovering your blackness in the mirror, baby. It's more like a chive on your tooth, spaghetti stains on your sweater. Everyone's giggling. You're the last to know.
What's the title of that one again?
Old Music. It's, you know, I was thinking about, well, people, relatives at family gatherings, but the fact that the trainers at my gym laugh at me because they say, oh, that's Reuben. He's got like 50 Earth, Wind & Fire compilations in his locker. And you find yourself reaching that age when you still listen to new things, but the older stuff starts to grow. And I thought, oh my gosh, I've become one of those people. And so this was kind of a way of, well, again, it's sort of a composite, but I was, you know, sort of self-mocking because you become, I remember the day I became my mother, and then I thought, well, so this is the day I became, you know, the guy watching the kids walk down the street and, you know, boy, I wish they'd pull up their pants, you know. Like those pants are so low. And I thought, oh, boy, here we are, you know.
You hit the mark. You crossed over the border. What music your father liked is what you cut your teeth on, and that was the more lyrical, would you say it made the lyric error? In his was more conventional swing or
I would say
blues.
Well, certainly, my father loved the blues, and he loved what I guess what people call kind of gut bucket stuff, like Lightnin' Hopkins, and Muddy Waters. Well, it's interesting, see, because my mother, my grandfather was a sharecropper, and my mother's father was a minister. Her mother was a teacher. So my parents had this sort of inter-class marriage. And so for her, the blues was like, she loved B.B. King because it was a little sweeter. But my father loved that boom, 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 that slow 4/4 Muddy Waters stuff. But I now know he was a romantic because he loved, he too loved ballads a lot. And he would play these songs in the basement over and over again. And I think he was very sentimental in his own way, and that certainly had an impact on me. I think my genes were probably stamped at birth anyway with the sentimental mark, you know. But, so it was a combination of those things. But my mother was the one who was listening to Michael Jackson and doing aerobics in the basement. And
you have a poem with Michael Jackson in it.
My father had the Glenn Miller stuff on, you know, because it was. It was sort of sweet and soft, and so they were an interesting mix. I mean, certainly it's one of the reasons I have been trying to just kind of write about them.
Maybe you got that, the lushness from him and the music, the analytical side from her.
That's probably true. I mean, they both are analytical. My irreverence comes from her, and she was, and I would say is, she was a shy person who loved people. And I mean, I am that.
Oh, a shy person who loved people. There's the fourth book.
But the stubbornness is all hers. Thanks, Mom. It's her birthday. Love you.
Oh, good, good. This is her birthday. Yeah. She can hear it vibrationally. Reuben Jackson has a poem with Michael Jackson in it. You know, were we all rooting for him when he was up there dancing and you were watching him and everybody just loved that so much? You have that in one of your poems.
I do, and I can't remember. I don't have it with me. I know what you're talking about. And because I, you know, part of the sort of the ritual of performance had a big impact on me, going to like the Howard Theater and seeing people in the 60s and sort of moving forward from there. Wilson Pickett and all those people. And it's funny, I was, you know, at the gym recently, and there was a Michael Jackson video on the monitor. And this guy said, oh, man, you know, why are they showing that? And I said, listen, you know, no matter what you think.
Absolutely.
I said, this guy is just phenomenal. He's, you know, he's an artistic genius. 52 West 8th Street. We take 6th Avenue to the Village, pause for hot dogs in Washington Square Park, rush past the weekend crowds on a pilgrimage. Part of my tour of New York includes pausing at a pot-bellied building beside the 8th Street Playhouse. Nancy snaps a photograph. Jimi Hendrix's studio, I mumble to passing tourists who don't remember seeing this on their list of downtown hotspots, and to Nancy, who notices poster of Jimmy and Mozart in an upstairs window, snapping it just as it begins to rain. By now, I am tripping. I see a man cross McDougal who looks like Billy Cox, Jimmy's last bassist. I am weaving like a blue note laced with strychnine. The air smells of patchouli. It is late August 1970. Jimmy is talking to a friend about mixes for his new album, which he'll complete when he returns from England. I ask if he'll pause for a picture. His turquoise belt is beautiful in the sun.
Great last line. Is that true?
Yeah, we were actually in New York. My friend Nancy Seeger, who actually works here at Library of Congress, and I were in New York, and I dragged everybody. I said, you know, this was Jimi Hendrix's studio. I dragged them down to the West Village, and I just sort of had this fantasia about Hendrix coming out, because this was some years actually after his death. But that weekend, there's something about New York and writing for me. I tell people, it's like if I get off the train at Penn Station, it's like the poems are waiting, and they go, come on, come on, come on, come on. And the weekend I wrote this, and probably a third of Finger in the Keys was done in like a 3-day, because it's like that energy is just boom, 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 boom. And it was like some kind of
fever.
We
were meant to be there. I have to go up once in a while.
It's so wonderful. It's the place I've always felt just very comfortable. And I'm always very just kind of enlivened.
Reuben Jackson's here. He's so good. I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is the Dorothy and Dick program, if you were old enough to remember that, Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick. And so we have time for another poem.
Okay. I'm going to do Leroy, actually. Interestingly enough, there's a dance company in Arlington, Virginia, called the Jane Franklin Dance Company. And they have this series called Dancing the Page, where they've taken poems by local writers, myself, Kim Roberts is one, some other people, and choreographed them. And this poem, Leroy, is one of the poems of mine they chose. And it's a fascinating thing to see this because, well, A, you learn something new about the pieces. I mean, no matter how old they are. And
I wish I had seen that.
It's a different interpretation. Yeah, yeah, it's a fascinating. It's also just a real honor. So, Leroy. When Leroy went shopping, clothes danced off the racks, parading before him like call girls. The shine on his Italian loafers glistened clear to Naples, not to mention Southeast D.C., with ultra-smooth, multisyllabic words for the ladies and the latest romantic albums. He'd spread his arms like Christ of the Andes while the rest of us mortal brothers put our love lives on hold. Leroy, cool, strong man, you still stroll through my infrequent recollections, days when weekends meant 25-cent double features and you were always first in line.
I was just glancing at this book, Prayer, about holding Miles' muted cries near to your heart as breath, and how much you honor musicians in almost in every poem. Everyone.
Yeah,
if it's not a reference, it's a background hum that we know is coming from somewhere very deep, a song you're playing under your breath.
It's certainly a, if nothing else, it's a springboard for exploration. Ladies' Way for Billie Holiday. Band plays an intro sad as the end of summer. She sings, a saxophone answers. It's shiny and tilted like the moon. Her voice rises like sun sometimes, dips like fortune or mountain road. She knows love's two faces like I know the way to market. And she knows some other stuff I feel. Guess that's why she's a star, crossing the country with a flower for her trademark and music for her flame.
The voice of Reuben Jackson we will remember for a very long time. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. We wish to thank the motion picture, broadcasting, and recorded sound division of the Library of Congress. You can hear these programs on www.loc.gov/poetry/poetpoem. This series is brought to you by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. Our engineer is Larry Applebaum. I'm Grace Cavalieri.